Well, you know what I think. I'm a Christian. I'm not going to deny that.
I do want everyone to feel comfortable. And that's why I'd like to talk to you about Jesus.
Please do not go religious.
Somebody's going to hell over there.
He better not.
Even the devil will speak the truth for his own purposes.
This is war.
Accept it.
Back to Jerusalem podcast.
Yeah, I'm back and I'm armed with righteousness.
With your host, Eugene Bach.
He just seems like he's got it all figured out.
He's a righteous dude.
Yep.
Hello and welcome to another Back to Jerusalem podcast. I'm Eugene Bach for your host for this time, and I'm coming to you live on delay from somewhere within the borders of America this time. Actually in DC, and I have a good friend with me that is joining me online from Idaho. I've actually had her on our podcast before. You might remember her, Nagme Panahi. Thank you so much for being back on our podcast, Nagme.
Thanks for having me.
And how has the book been doing?
Really good, I think.
Really? Yeah. That's good.
I'm getting a lot of emails and feedbacks and just from all scopes of life and experiences.
I did a for those of you that don't know, I've done a podcast with Nagme several times, I think, in the past. We've talked about Iran, and sometimes when there's been situations, I can remember one time I called you from Brazil, and we did a podcast over online at that time. And then we ended up doing a book about her life, and it is a powerful story about how she was a part of the very genesis of the revivals inside of Iran with the growth of the Underground House Church. And then she went through a very public separation with her husband, who was all over the news when he was arrested and thrown in prison in Iran, met together with some of the most high officials in the world, including the U.S. presidents, both Obama and Trump, and at one time even cornered the president of Iran and had him trapped and addressed him face to face.
Yeah, it feels like five lifetimes, but different lives. But yes, from just the house church movement in Iran to meeting with presidents and advocacy and just different journeys that God has us on, which is not always a straight line.
No, it wasn't. And I mean, you've now got some distance between the hardship that you went through when your ex-husband was put in prison, and you went through a very abusive situation that people can read about in the book, and you took time off from everything to heal, put some distance there, and now you've been used by God to really make those connections again in Iran and work with the Underground House Church there. And we've been working together with you as you work together with them and serve them.
Yeah, it's interesting because 25 years ago is when I was really involved with the House Church movement. We were in our 20s. It was growing quickly, and, you know, we went through different seasons, coming to the U.S., having our kids, and then Saeed getting arrested and advocacy. So there was a good, I think, 10 years of little contact with the Underground House Churches. And right around the time, a lot of things fell apart in my life. As you said, there was a journey of healing. God just started bringing people back from 20-some years ago. And, you know, they people that I had discipled, people that I had worked closely with, and they were all, they all start coming back and saying, we trust you. We've had such an intimate, a lot of us were arrested together. We were part of the beginning of the revival, seeing all of that together. And just, it's been amazing seeing how God has slowly brought everyone back. And now we're working together again for the mission in Middle East, which now includes, a lot of the people I'm working with are also now doing work in Afghanistan and Iraq.
You know, and I mean, there's a lot of people that may not know your story intimately. They can easily get it if they buy your book and read through the entire story. It's a powerful story. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've known you for a while, and I've never seen you as an ambitious person. And when I say that, it's not that I'm not saying that you're relaxed or lazy or anything like that. What I'm saying is that I've never seen you can meet certain people And they always want to do something more in ministry. They want to be more visible in ministry. They want to be more well known in ministry. They want to do more projects in ministry that will get them, you know, more exposure, highlighted more. You've never struck me as that kind of person. The reason I say that, as I used it as a preface for, you were not the kind of person that says, okay, I'm ready for ministry now. I'm going to go out and start doing what I was doing before. But it felt very much like you were needed. And so individuals from Iran, if I understand correctly, were calling you, reaching out to you, pulling you back in, sometimes even reluctantly, where you didn't want to be so much involved or in leadership. And the reason I say that is because there's a lot of people that might be like, well, you know, what are you doing, you know, going back into this work when you had gone through this whole thing with your ex-husband? Don't you feel like maybe that's not your role anymore? Go ahead.
I would say the exact same thing people are saying. Yeah. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do advocacy. I didn't want to do house church. It really had a lot of PTSD for me because the house church movement, I don't know if you, something you start with someone, like the memories of it, you know, so the house church movement really started with Saeed. And it really, a lot of our first dates and first get-togethers, all of that. So touching that again, or also advocacy, you know, reaching, you know, close to a billion people advocating to get Saeed out of prison and meeting with presidents. And it became a sensitive subject because Saeed was so much part of it. And it brought me back to the heartbreak of how everything unfolded, which was my husband divorcing me. But there was just so much more going through that. So what pulled me back in was our mutual friends that you actually know. They're the ones that pretty much grabbed me. They live in Canada now, so I can talk more freely. My Massa, she was a teenager when I first met her, and her sister Moral, she was, I think, 10 years old, and Massa was, I think, I don't know, 17 or something. And I'd known them, and now they're, you know, approaching 40 and late 30s or 30. And so Massa had become a single mom. And at that time, I had stopped advocacy. I had nothing to do with the house church movement. And she contacted me and she said, I'm a single mom. I really need your help. And there's a lot of women coming out of prostitution that are single moms too. And for my heart was like, okay, you know what? It's this one single mom. So I started helping her personally. And then soon after, and we started a small Bible study, maybe with five people, her mom, who's an amazing cook, Shireen. And we started a Bible study with her, her mom, and Marl. And so that's like 20 years later. And then Marl got arrested and she was put in solitary confinement. She was being tortured. And I knew her since she was 10. So it wasn't just a random Christian getting arrested. It was someone I knew since she was like, got saved at age 10. And this passionate girl for Christ who is, you know, so she was like my daughter. And so I reluctantly got involved and I didn't want to be on the spotlight. So I called our mutual friend, Maryam Ibrahim, who you've also written her story. And I said, Maryam, I don't want to get involved with advocacy again. But this is what's happened. This girl that's like a sister, like a daughter to me, she's in prison. Actually, when I talked to Maryam, she was in near DC area. We had gotten Marl a Iranian human rights lawyer, and we were just able to get her out on bail. So Marl, I had a video of Marl coming out on bail, hugging her mom, hugging her sisters. And I sent it to Maryam, and Maryam started crying. She said, we got to get her help. And so that really started the advocacy. Maryam stepping in, we went to DC, we met with Andrew Brunson, which I saw that he's going to be one of your speakers.
Yes.
At the conference, at the persecution conference in October. And so we met with Andrew Brunson. It just got started having divine appointments. So Maryam was invited to the Coptic Coptic Christianity 10-year anniversary, and her and Andrew Brunson both got an award as persecuted Christians. And so we got to meet him, and we got to meet with Ambassador Brownback at that time. And so God just started opening doors with like politicians and ambassadors. And so really it became a long journey, but now these girls are safe in Canada. I think you've visited a few times. And so that's really what pulled me in. And then these girls, their networks start growing to hundreds and start with five women. And so that's how it started. And then just people that I had known again started coming in and saying, you know, we trust you. I don't want to put anyone, but they'd gone through a lot of abuse as sheep, by bad shepherds using their wool and using them to make money in ministry and discarding them when they needed help. Like, you know, for example, someone like Marl, who when she was arrested, no ministry wanted to do anything with her. So they were used. And as soon as they got trapped, a lot of these ministries didn't want to help them. So my heart was to just help people I had known since they were teenagers. And now I'm like in my 40s. And that's how it came together. But I didn't want to touch it. I didn't want to do another advocacy thing. There's in prison, like I felt ashamed to even touch that anymore, because it's like I'd advocated to get my husband out, and then the abuse stuff came out. So I was kind of labeled as like a liar. And so I didn't want to I was under like a lot of shame to even talk about advocacy anymore, especially. But the house church too, there was so much of Saeed wrapped up in it and so many memories that I didn't really want to touch it.
And I mean, throughout the Bible, there's just this overwhelming number of individuals that are used by God that were reluctant. And the best reluctance is not like, oh, I don't want to do it, it's just too hard. That was not true reluctance. Your reluctance, at least from an observer's point of view, from my point of view, was I don't feel that's my role. And there's so many people in the Bible that God uses greatly that basically comes before him and says, I can't do that because I'm not worthy. And we, I think, in the Christian world are oftentimes bombarded by individuals who promote their worthiness, that really, you know, tell everybody and beat them over the brow with the fact that they are more holy than everybody else, and they are better than everybody else, and they are more prepared and capable than everybody else. But I've seen you pulled into very unique situations, and then you just kind of come alive where God moves in your life in a unique way where he just couldn't work through others. And I've seen that in Iran. I've seen that in Turkey. And I've seen that most recently in Afghanistan. And what can you tell us about what's been taking place lately in Afghanistan? Because I've worked in Afghanistan for a couple of years through a couple of different people in different routes. The way that we are working with you in Afghanistan is the most unique and the most evangelistic we've ever had as an opportunity in Afghanistan ever.
Yeah, so it's interesting you're saying that. I was just getting some of the testimonies where there's six people, husband and wife, and four other men. So five men and one woman that were just discipling to go out, just, you know, brand new converts, which might not seem like a huge, but as we're building this team and also working in the underground with the Taliban, really, I feel like it's harder working under the Taliban than the Iranian government. They seem to be more aware of what's happening and being able to track things. So learning to maneuver in that country and being not, hurting the ministry. But yeah, I was reluctant because I felt like, before I go to Afghanistan, I felt like that season was over. Like, I've never held on to anything. Like, this is my ministry. So like when the house church movement was over, then it was, I became a wife and a mother and I focused more on that. I was more into the business world. Then Saeed got in prison. Then I became an advocate because I was thrown into it. So a lot of the ministries I've been like, even going to Iran and being part of the house church movement, my goal was to share the gospel with my cousins. It wasn't like, I didn't have this grand vision of like revival, and God allowed me to be a part of that. I was reluctant to go back into that because I felt like those chapters were closed and I was in a new journey. My focus now was helping abused women and women that had gone through hurt through the church. And so it's funny how God reeled me in through that, because it was a single mom in Iran, that Massa, that really got me involved. So the reluctancy came from, I feel like those seasons were over. But Afghanistan, all of them really, you know, I recently reached out to you asking about some things that had come up in Pakistan. I'm reluctant to step into countries or ministries that I don't know the person for a long time. So it's interesting, even Afghanistan, God used a 20-year relationship to bring this about. And it just kind of flourished as everything else was coming together. And so we are doing a lot of work together there I don't want to go into too much detail, but it is a lot of evangelism that we're just really surprised of how just God is moving. A lot of, as a lot of people might know, since the Taliban took over, women have lost a lot of, we've noticed with the religion of Islam, especially when they take over certain countries, the people that are hurt the most are women and vulnerable women. So they're not allowed to be educated. I think the girls are allowed to only be educated till sixth grade or something. But even then, it's hard to get that kind of education for girls. They're not allowed to go to, you know, college, obviously. They're not allowed to leave the house without a male headship, a male. So if you're a widow, what do? And you don't have a son, and you have daughters, which a lot of these women do. And so they're stuck in their house and they're starving. But we're seeing how God is using a lot of these widows and their children that are now being raised up in the Lord to reach other Afghanis for the gospel. So it's really exciting, and getting them Bibles and training them and so on.
Now, I mean, what you've just described is, I think, something that is really important that I want to capitalize on in case our audience missed it, which is, these are Iranians that are being sent as missionaries doing mission work in Afghanistan. Not a lot of nationalities are accepted in Afghanistan. Not a lot of nationalities can understand the language right off the bat, in Afghanistan as an Iranian. I mean, there's a lot of shared language, a lot of shared culture, a lot of shared history, and a lot of shared government persecution. So, yes. I mean, the people coming from Iran going in Afghanistan, they understand the challenges in a unique way, because they're going through them themselves. They understand Islam. They understand Islam from an Asian perspective. But a lot of people think of Iran as being Arabic, and it's not. Iran is actually Asian, as is Afghanistan. So both Afghanistan and Iran are Asian nations. And so you have a unique identification with Islam that you don't get in the Middle East, in other countries.
Yeah, you have to. I think you know the dynamic. There's certain people group that Iranians accept too, and the same with Afghanis. And so it's really important who is able to go into these countries, and are they accepted as someone to, you know, share with them, and as a place of respect. And that relationship exists between Persians. I mean, Afghanis are also Persians. So that relationship exists between these two countries. But over the years, we've actually been able to, a lot of the work is actually being done by the Afghanis, which some of them, again, we had met years ago in Iran, because Afghanis, a lot of Afghanis have become refugees in Iran. They cross the border. They, you know, they're there. And so I was actually our contact. The way that came about, again, that trust that has been built over the years, is he was a refugee in Iran, got saved in Iran. There was a relationship there. And then he felt like God had called him back to go back to Afghanistan.
Powerful.
And yeah, so it's, our goal is, yes, as Iranians, to be able to get into certain places, even like the way God has opened the door in Iraq is Iranian Kurdish believers. So that Kurdish combination, now the Iranian Kurds are able to reach the Iraqi Kurds. And then the Iraqi Kurds, of course, their culture is more Iraqi, so they're able to reach more of the Iraqi culture. And so where the goal is, yes, to use the influence of Iranian missionaries in these countries, but ultimately to have the local be saved and have them become the ones that kind of carry on the torch.
Yeah, I mean, I've just written a book. It's an edit right now. You probably know the person, but from a different name than I do. He was the very first Christian to ever be thrown in prison for his faith under the new regime. He was grandson of the Ayatollah. And when the Taliban took over Afghanistan, there was so much confusion that he was able to fly into Afghanistan and become an Afghani. They gave him an Afghan passport because he spoke the language. I mean, not perfectly, but, you know, as an Iranian, he was able to adapt very quickly, understand it. And then the longer he was there, the more he was able to communicate like an Afghan. Mm-hmm. And so as an Afghan or as an Iranian now, he actually carries an Afghan passport and is able to minister to the Afghan people.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And that would have never happened had the Taliban not taken over. And so there's some really bad things about the Taliban taking over, but God has his control. And out of the Taliban, in many ways, at least for us as a ministry, more doors are open now than there ever was under the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. The U.S. was actually more controlling than most people understand, like really wanting to, they did more to protect Islam than open up the doors for markets in Afghanistan. And it was a real shame. There is a story that we've actually shared that most people don't know, that in Afghanistan, there were believers in the U.S. military that were being approached by Afghanis when the U.S. military was there, and they were coming up to the soldiers and they were begging the soldiers, "Can you share with us about your God?" Because the Afghanis saw that the U.S. troops, even though they were carrying weapons and had superior firepower, that the Americans were bringing in good things. Food and schools and roads and business and education. Who does that to their enemies? Muhammad didn't do that to his enemies. It was submit or die. So there was something different. So the Afghans began to approach U.S. troops. Well, U.S. troops really didn't know what to do because they were there for soldiering, not ministering. So they wrote back to their churches in America to send them Bibles. And America responded en masse. Many churches began to send Bibles to Afghanistan. Thousands of Bibles arrived. When the commander of the U.S. troops learned about this new movement, he ordered all of these Bibles to be collected, tens of thousands of them, and pulled onto Bagram Base, and they were all burned.
Wow.
They were all burned. People really, when they hear me share about that for the first time, they're like, why have I never heard about this? It was all over the news. I guarantee you this, if those troops would have burned Qurans, that would have been wall-to-wall news coverage. Mm-hmm. But because they burned Bibles and they asked the commander, why did you burn these Bibles? And we wrote about it at Back to Jerusalem. And the commander said this, he said, because they said, you know, you could have just sent them back to the churches. Why did you have to burn them? And his response was, we burned them because we knew if we sent them back to the churches would find another way to get them back. Mm-hmm. And the way that we deal with garbage is we burn it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I think maybe there was a season, like you said, it feels the last couple of years, because I've personally tried to reach Afghanis, whether locally, Afghani refugees, but there's, and whether trying to get into the country. In the last 2 years, it seems like there's been more openness to the gospel, like you said, which is since the troops left and since Taliban took over, which doesn't make sense that would be the case. But God has, there's been a shift in the spiritual realm with the Afghanis and being their openness. Maybe it was there, but they were never given the opportunity to hear the gospel. But there's such an openness to the gospel right now.
There's an openness. And I think one of the things that we missed, and I think that you would agree with this, but the moment that we burned Bibles in Afghanistan was the moment that we lost Afghanistan, because we did everything. We did everything. And when I say we, I'm talking about as an American. You're an American as well. We did everything. America brought in the world's top experts on how to build an economy, how to build a government, how to set up a legislation. We brought in voting. We brought in education. We educated women. We brought in freedoms. We brought in all of the ingredients that you need for a democracy. We poured it in and we stirred it around to make a democracy soup, if you will. And it didn't work. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the main ingredient of what makes free societies free is not any of the other things. We had a military to provide security. We had a military that conquered the nation of Afghanistan, overthrew their government, kicked them out, had total and absolute control. And it failed. Why? Because the transformation is not external. It's internal. And without the gospel, you can't have freedom. The Bible very clearly says where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty, which also means where the Spirit of the Lord isn't, or in many places in this country, they may say ain't. Where the Spirit of the Lord ain't, there ain't no democracy. There ain't no freedom. And so for those of you that were listening and being like, oh, I've never heard this before, you can look it up. It's actually on Wikipedia. It's called the Bagram Bible Program. And they write it as a scandal. And it says the scandal occurred at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan in 2009 that Christians were sending Bibles to troops. And it wasn't, they weren't sending Bibles to the troops because the troops wanted to proselyze. That was completely wrong. The troops were just responding to the hunger of the people. And America kept the gospel out. And the only reason I want to bring this up is because now it seems like under the Taliban, there's more opportunity for the gospel to actually get in than there was under the U.S. government, which is a very sad statement on the state of affairs for today's Afghanistan.
I want to add that it's interesting you say that. It sounds so simple to say the solution is Jesus when people have tried so hard with, like you said, the military and the political structure. They've tried so much to create this democracy because that's how I felt when I went to Iran after September 11. People were going to send troops to the Middle East. Iran has always been a problem, always been the one involved with terrorism and all that. And I just knew like the solution to people of Iran changing and understanding democracy and understanding basically that the government they're under is false was Christ. And so that's been what we're seeing in Iran. I mean, the government's still holding on to the power, but the people are becoming Christian. The people are no longer, even with the Mahsa Amini thing that happened a couple years ago, where Iran was again very close to a revolution, is women taking off their head coverings, saying we're done. The Iranian people are no longer just wanting reform, which is what they've always wanted. They just try to reform their government. Now they're saying we're done with the Islamic government. Like, we don't want Islamic government anymore. We're done with Islam. But at the same time, so many are continue to become Christians. And so the solution to all the problems we see in the world might be simple, but it really is Jesus. It really is the gospel and changing people from within.
While I was talking to you and while you were talking, I just looked it up really quick to see if I could get that quote, because I wasn't for sure if I was correct, and I was wrong. The commanding officer of Bagram Base did say that he burned the Bible because it was trash, but it was the chaplain. The chaplain of the U.S. military, this is according to CNN, so I'm looking at a CNN article from 2009, and it says this: the chaplain later corrected the soldier and confiscated the Bibles. The military officers considered sending the Bibles back to the church, the chaplain said, but they worried that the church would turn around and send them to another organization in Afghanistan. Sure. So the U.S. military were protecting Islam in Afghanistan. The people in Afghanistan wanted the Bible. And I don't know if you've heard this or not. I looked it up, and as far as it can be proven, it's been proven that right now there are 75,000 mosques in Iran, roughly, give or take, about 75,000, and about 50,000 of them have been shut down because nobody's going, nobody's attending. And and that goes to what you were saying. The people are hungry. And we have to remember that the government of Iran is not a representation of the Iranian people. They are the rulers, and they rule with a very strong iron fist. That when people do not, you know, speak the way they want them to speak, dress the way they want them to dress, believe the way they want them to believe, they're punished. And that punishment is exacerbated throughout the society by using different people in the society. So authority figures, teachers, just a lot of different people within the social structure are used to enforce that fear. But the people are hungry. I mean, you're seeing that. What are you seeing today? I know that you lived in Iran, you were a missionary in Iran, but what are you seeing today with the people that you gave us a little bit of insight, saying that you had just, you know, spoken to some people earlier? Or do you feel like the number of people that are coming to Christ are increasing, decreasing, staying the same? What is your feeling right now?
In Iran?
Yes.
It's actually increasing. I personally have had family members that have been kind of considered themselves Muslim, but not practicing Muslim, that in the last few years, they've said, I'm no longer a Muslim. I don't associate myself with Islam anymore.
Wow.
And what you're seeing with the mosque shutting down, people no longer, and this again has happened through seeing the true Islam, because Iran is run by the Islamic law. And also that our people are now more open to the gospel. They don't go to the mosques. And even since the Mahsa Amini thing, they a lot of people are not just wanting to reform Islam, their Islamic government. They're completely done with Islam. And we're seeing that more and more. We actually had a lot of people during the protests with the Mahsa Amini, which happened a couple of years ago, I think in September, maybe a year and a half ago. A lot of people became Christian around that time. They said, we're done with Islam. This is all we've known. And they were searching for, they're not anti-God. That's interesting, because some of them leave Islam and become atheists. But what we've seen is they've become, they've left Islam, but still want God. And they don't know what that would look like. And so just the teachings I still do, I teach through different apps, disciple leaders in Iran. And there's just been so many that are just being raised up even since the mass, just the last couple of years. So I would say it's growing.
Wow.
The number, it's growing more so than 25 years ago when I was there. There was still this pride of people saying, well, I'm Muslim. And there was still this association with being Muslim. But I would say a lot of Iranians are no longer even wanting to associate with Islam.
Wow. I mean, that's been, we've been seeing that for a little bit of time, even labeling that as ABI, anything but Islam, has been a kind of a sensation that's been running through Iran for several years now. And one of the things that we have been excited about is that it feels that Iranians are starting to really look at a lot of their history, and their history has to do with God and the Bible. And your story was very interesting, because you talked about, you know, where your dad was at during the revolution, when the revolution took place in 1979, where your mom was at. You know, your mom worked for the military. She worked for the Shah. She was a beneficiary of the open policies that the Shah was implementing, and your dad was more on the Islamic side. And I think there were a lot of people in Iran that were very much like your dad. They saw very real problems in Iran. They saw desperation. They saw poverty. They didn't like the secularization where women were, you know, wearing short mini skirts. Some of those short mini skirts we saw in your mom. but there were many people that were against that. They saw the Shah making closer relationships with Israel, and they were against that. And a lot of the problems that they saw was they associated with Iran drifting away from Islam. And yes. So you had a lot of these very conservative Muslims that said, if we can bring in full Islam, you will see that everything will be better. The Shah will not be so rich. All of those riches will go to everybody. You'll get universal health care. You'll get university salaries or universal salary where you actually get money from the government to pay your utilities, and you'll get free fuel, free gas, and all of the wealth of all of the riches of our fossil fuels will go directly to you instead of one person, the Shah. And people like that idea. They're like, wow, free education, free healthcare, free gas money. We'll all be rich, and our lives will be better because Islam will make things more pure. And yes. One of the benefits, if there's any benefits, at least in my opinion, you can say what you feel, but one of the benefits that I've witnessed of the Ayatollah being in charge is that people learned the real truth of Islam.
Yes.
They're no longer under the impression of, well, we just need to become more Islamic and then we'll find the good parts of life. They find that the more Islamic they go, the more misery they inherit from Islam.
And there's no way reforming it. They thought maybe we're not understanding it correctly. Maybe if there's a more Islamic president that's more like reform, you know, understanding Islam better to give more freedom. But 2 years ago, the Iranian people realized, no, it's not about reforming the government or Islam, or we have to get, you know, do away with Islam altogether. This is what's been destroying our country. And that's why you said it's ABI, anything but Islam. That's really the reality of where people are at in Iran. They do not want to be associated as Muslims anymore. They're done with it.
Yeah. And people that know Islam don't want Islam. That's something that we see very strongly. In the West, you have people that are like, oh, no, there's so many good things about Islam. In fact, all of your laws of freedom were based on Islamic teachings. And so people have bought into this. There was a lady that I saw. She was not covered. She was debating with people about, you know, the strengths of Islam, the influence of Islam, the goodness of Islam. And she was arguing for Islam. And there was a guy that just questioned her about the five pillars. You know, and he was just saying, well, what about this and the five pillars? And it turned out that she didn't know the five pillars. So she didn't know the
essential.
Yeah, that is the basic. That's basic Islam. I mean, I'm not asking you to quote the Quran. I'm not asking you to remember a passage or a surah. The five basic pillars. And she didn't know them. Like she goes, no, I know them. And then she tried to name them. She couldn't name any of them. And it just shows that so many people today that are trying to be voices for, quote unquote, the goodness of Islam don't know Islam. The people that do know Islam, like those living in Iran today, don't want Islam. So,
and Afghanistan now.
Do you see a growing number of believers in Afghanistan like you're seeing in Iran, or is it, are you able to tell?
It's like the little cloud we're seeing movement. Mm. Whereas, like when I went to Iran in my 20s, there was definitely an explosion where it was all these young people. But in Afghanistan, part of it is we're very cautious in how we move, but we're seeing a little, it's like the little cloud that's showing there's gonna be a storm, but we're seeing more and more. Whereas before it was such a hard soil, and now it's not even, God has really opened up the Afghani, even I'm seeing fruit here locally, with the Afghanis that have fled Afghanistan. And before I couldn't even reach any Afghanis, they would shut me down. They would be angry. I would get death threats. But now we're even seeing conversions, salvations here locally, but here in the U.S. But yes, we're seeing a lot more. Just in the last couple years, we've seen hundreds. That's a lot for Afghanistan, for us. In Iran, it might be in the people I'm connected with, it's in the thousands, but for us, the hundreds is a lot. And just try to move slowly, trying to move carefully. And like I said, the new discipleship class, is 5 men and 1 woman. That's pretty amazing that we have that many men. A lot of the people we've targeted have been widows and women that have been really desperate, but we're also seeing a lot of men become followers of Christ and be willing to pay the price for that. I mean, there's a lot of fear in Afghanistan if you're found out that you're a Christian. I would say there's more fear in Afghanistan than it is in Iran. We're seeing a lot of conversions. It's more slowly than the explosion I saw in Iran, but for sure it's spreading. And as we are growing disciples and sending them out to different regions.
I want to be sensitive with your time. I want to get to your book, but before I do, you said something that kind of triggered me, and I want to get your take on something. You know, I've been working in China for more than 20 years, quickly coming up on 25 years, working together with what we call the Back to Jerusalem movement, this idea of the Chinese church rising up and taking the gospel into other nations. Just 100 years ago, if I look at the number of Christians, where the most Christians were kind of congregated on the globe, more than 90% of them were in America and Europe. Today, that has completely changed. In only 100 years, from 1924 into 2024, we see that more than 60% of the world's Christian body is now in Asia and Africa. Mm-hmm. That is a massive shift. It reminds me of our main verse and Back to Jerusalem, which is Matthew 24:14, that the good news of the kingdom will be preached to all the nations and then the end will come. Well, I've been working and kind of focused on the Chinese and going into other countries, but now I'm starting to see that movement of Back to Jerusalem, going from east to west all the way back to Jerusalem, is not just China-centric. I was just in Vietnam a couple weeks ago, where the Vietnamese want to rise up and take the gospel outside of Vietnam into other countries. I've just talked with you for the last half hour or more, and you're talking about, you know, Iranians rising up and taking the gospel into other nations. And it looks like this is a pattern. Uh-huh. And the number of unreached people groups is quickly being reached at a rate and a ferocity that we've never really seen before in history. And I'm just wondering what your take on that is. Do you feel that there is a movement of nations that have been closed, not just rising up and seeing movement within their own borders, but a desire to take the gospel outside of their culture, context, nation into other nations?
I mean, that's amazing what you said about Vietnam. Is that right?
Yep.
The Vietnamese. I think it's really all of us from different nations doing our part, you know, and whatever that looks like, providing the resources that the Chinese need, the Vietnamese need. I remember in our 20s when we were the house church explosion, all these young people had visions of taking the gospel, becoming a missionary center, that Iran would become a missionary center, that it would send out missionaries. And so it's interesting, all these countries that are experiencing revival and there's people becoming Christians, they have this vision of sending out missionaries, kind of like probably what we had seen in the US and Europe. And I think that's beautiful because there's something about Asians reaching Asians. Mm. And there's something about just the culture, understanding a lot of our own culture, whether it's, you know, Chinese, whether it's Persians, Iranians, Vietnamese, there's still something in being from that region that unifies. And each of us, you know, taking, I think God's just bringing the puzzle pieces together. Mm. I think it's the Holy Spirit laying it on the Vietnamese hearts to send out missionaries to certain regions, the same with the Chinese. When I was in Iran, we also got to work with some South Koreans that were there, and they knew their Farsi was amazing. And so there's something about God using the body as you know, it doesn't to do that. And I think that's beautiful. And I think that's needed. I think it's very effective. We're seeing a lot of effectiveness. Not a lot of Americans or Europeans are able to go into these countries, but within Asia, you can travel and people are more open to each other in that region. So I think that's amazing. I didn't know that about Vietnam, but I think it's interesting that each of these countries have this vision of taking the gospel to where people have not heard the gospel before, and God's using it in a mighty way.
And on that note, I think Iran is specially placed because they then become that link between Asia and the Middle mm-hmm. East. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of like the final frontier, right? That final aggression is in that region of Islam, and Islam having its home on the Arab Peninsula. And when we look at the wars and the battles that are taking place with Israel, the aggression towards Israel, a lot of that is with the brothers, right?
Yes.
Right? You have Isaac never really getting along with his brother ever. Isaac not being liked by his brother ever. And so Ishmael, the children of Ishmael, are that final frontier, and that link might very well be Iran. So that was interesting. So we have Mother's Day that's going to be coming up very soon. And so we felt that this Mother's Day, it would be great to put together the three books that we've done with you. You mentioned Miriam earlier, Miriam Ibrahim, and then also Esther, Sister Esther from North Korea. We have three books that we're putting together in one package: Smuggling Light, which is the story about a woman in North Korea being thrown in prison in North Korea. She was also thrown in prison in China, beaten and tortured for her belief in Christ. Also Shackled, which is the story of Miriam Ibrahim, mm-hmm. Who you had brought up, and her testimony of going through the death row, being on death row in Sudan, the nation of Sudan. And then you, your story in the book, I Didn't Survive. That book about talking about emerging whole after deception, persecution, and hidden abuse is really kind of one of the strong books in that trio that brings a light to so many people, because it's hard for people to understand being in a prison in North Korea. It's not easy for people to identify with being shackled and on death row mm-hmm. in Sudan. I do think that there is a link with you that people can understand a little bit more: domestic violence, hidden abuse that stays a little closer to home. And that's why I feel that that's such a great book to have for Mother's Day, and even, you know, women's Bible studies for this time of the year.
Yeah, I want to say something that's interesting is when we read about the persecuted church, you know, and these stories, and I met Esther on the last conference we had together, Sister Esther from North Korea, or who was a missionary in North Korea. I think a lot of times is like, wow, those are heroes of faith. But I think in my book, I talk about it. I think there is a message that we can take away for the American church, for the church in the West, from the persecuted church, that we often forget to do that. It's just, we kind of see it out there, but it's really, God has a message from those churches that we can take here and hopefully see revival here and learn from the persecuted church there. I think a lot of times from the West, we've taken things that try to teach, you know, take it to Asia or Middle East. And I think now it's the time where we sit under the feet of the persecuted church and learn from them. Mm. I think there's a lot to learn. And I think there's a lot of benefit to the church here to really listen to what's happening in the persecuted church. But for Sister Esther and Miriam, I want to say, like, for me as a woman reading women's missionary stories like Amy Carmichael, Corrie Ten Boom, it really gave me this vision that, you know, I'd also read like Hudson Taylor and all of that. But reading about women missionaries, like Mother's Day, giving women stories about women missionaries, women who have counted the cost for the gospel, I think it really motivated me to say, you know what, I can be a missionary. Amy Carmichael just was the single woman who went to India, or, you know, Corrie Ten Boom, what she went through in the concentration camp, and how God used her to encourage the church here in the U.S. And so I think it really brings up, as young ladies and women read missionary stories about persecution and women who've stepped in, especially mothers. All three of us were mothers when we went through what we went through. I mean, the revival in Iran, but afterwards, for me, I was still a mother when I was chasing down the Iranian president and calling out Iran's a human rights violation. I think a lot of mothers and a lot of young ladies hopefully can see something and say, you know what, God can use me. I can, you know, as an ordinary person that might not see themselves, I felt like I was ordinary, just take steps for the gospel and see nations change as a result. And one of my favorite verses, I think it's Acts 4, I think it's somewhere in Acts, but it says, you know, these religious leaders were like bewildered by these disciples because they were uneducated and ordinary people. And they could tell, but they were courageous, but at the same time, they were so ordinary. And they said, and they realized that they were with Jesus. They were the ones that were with Jesus. Mm. And so ultimately, that's all it really is. It's not all of us are the same. We're not heroes. But it's that being with Jesus that makes us courageous and makes us ordinary, uneducated. We might not know, we might think we don't have the theological tools to maybe reach people with the gospel, but that's the kind of people God uses. So for me, these books could be an encouragement for even young women, mothers, to really get that fire of, what, okay, God, what is it you have for me in these dark times for the gospel?
And if you read these books, I think that they're quite honest as well. So they do kind of, I've been reading lately a lot of these older books, like by Amy Carmichael and lesser known missionaries. In fact, I've started a publishing company last year where we've started to publish some of these older stories that come from 150, 200 years ago or even more. We're about ready to do letters from a Portuguese nun that were written in the 1400s, 1500s. So, I mean, they go back, you know, many, many years, centuries. But if I read those, as powerful as they are, one of the things that I feel that these three books specifically do is they show the humanity of being a believer in extreme circumstances. So not necessarily extreme believers, but believers, ordinary believers in extreme circumstances, relying on an extraordinary God.
Yes.
And that I think is one of the things that kind of comes through, because I've written books before with pastors, and I won't name them, where I feel like there was a little bit of dishonesty in the way that I know specifically that they had failures. I've had failures. And with my failures, I think that I can not just relate. I'm not trying to highlight failures to be relatable. I highlight failures as a part of the testimony of the goodness of God, even when we are not so good. The testimony of God's dedication to us does not change, even when we fail. And so we have an entire Bible that goes through all of the details of failures of the heroes of faith for a purpose. The Quran doesn't do that. The
Book of
Buddha doesn't. Yep. The Book of Buddha doesn't do that. The Book of Vishnu doesn't do that. All of these are the highlight reels of their life. Whereas the Bible goes out of its way to show you the imperfection of the people that God uses. And these three books, I think, are written in honesty. There's a lot of, when I wrote your book together with you, I felt that you made yourself extremely vulnerable, as you often do. It's one of your endearing characteristics, that you often make yourself vulnerable. You wear your heart on your sleeve. And you do that in your book in such an amazing way that makes your story so much easier to read, because there is this vulnerability to hardship and failure and imperfection and a highlight not to your strength but to God's faithfulness, which we have with Esther, and I believe that we have also with Miriam.
And I think anyone can relate to that, because you don't have to be, as you said, extraordinary, but you read these stories of God's faithfulness to ordinary people extraordinary circumstances and very difficult circumstances. And, you know, then you can see that all you have to offer to God is yourself, uneducated, unordinary, and God can use that for the gospel. So all of us, I think with Esther and Miriam and me, we didn't really plan that out. We were just caught up in a situation that really tested our faith of what do you believe and are you willing to stand on it, even if it can cost you your life and everything. So yeah.
I think it's one of the things that people are surprised about with Brother Yun when they hear his story, especially how he survived for 74 days without drinking water or having any food. So he was 74 days with no water, no food. And I've heard Brother Yun talk very intimately about that, and he will share with people and say, you think that I did that because I was holy and wanted to be close to God. He was like, I did that because I gave up. I stopped eating and stopped drinking, not because I wanted to hear from God, but because I wanted to die. I was done. I was done with life. I gave up. Yeah. And
he's being honest.
Yeah.
I think I heard something like that about Andrew Brunson too.
Yes.
Like he's really real about how he was really actually not a hero in the prison. He kind of was going through a lot of turmoil and kind of giving up. And
oh, no, you're absolutely correct. I brought him with us to, we had a special meeting in Cambodia last year in December, where we brought together many house church leaders from inside of China. And I asked him to join me for a couple of days and just share his story. And so I listened into his story and it was very touching. He shared with the Chinese, he's like, you guys are heroes. I'm not. He was like, I didn't even go through hardship like I've heard you guys gone through. And I was done. And so he was very honest and open and said, guys, I don't like being uncomfortable. And I gave up. I quit. Like I started to doubt in God. And and so he really gave
up. He's very honest about that.
Very honest. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I met him, I was really surprised. He immediately tries because, he was in the news and I think Trump prayed for him. And so when we met him, he was kind of had just come out. And he really shuts you down to try to raise him up. He goes straight to the struggles he had with his faith, with depression, with all of this stuff. And it's really refreshing to see someone do that and not, go straight into his weaknesses. So I think that's, like you said, and it's the, I really felt like I could trust my story with you because part of it was that you are very real and authentic. And like you said, we've all had our issues and things like that, but you're not afraid. You don't hide it. You're like, this is what it is. And if you're going to stone me to death, stone me. I don't, I'm not going to hide this. And so that actually has, and I tell a lot of people that has, I don't trust a lot of organizations. I don't trust a lot of people. And it has actually helped me step into this, trustworthiness with you and the organization. I've seen we've known each other for I think 10 years now, maybe no more, 12 years. And so it's been a journey, and it's really been amazing in the recent years that God, as you said, has opened these doors up in Iran, now in Afghanistan, to really work together. And but it's this honesty, I think, that's missing in a lot of times in the Christian world, just to be honest and say, this is my journey, Miriam's, Esther's, like, we're just humans. But we're going to point to the one that is what got us through these times. And like you said, if giving these books away for Mother's Day, it would, hopefully it will be an encouragement for those who are interested in missions, but also maybe the everyday journey of how did these people get through this? And how can I get through my depression or, my anxiety or whatever I'm going, the loss of a loved one, or, it would help you in your own spiritual journey of going through whatever you're going through in the West, or wherever you're at.
Yeah. And I don't want to take anything away from Esther's book about North Korea. There's really no books out there about North Korea in the way that one was. That one was not easy for me to write, but when I got to Miriam's book and when I got to your book specifically, I really do feel that the Holy Spirit was with me, and words beyond my own ability began to formulate, take place, and shape. in a way that I can reread it and know that this was not me. This was not my style. This was not my vocabulary. This was not my artistic painting. And so I think that I say that to say, of course, I'm biased and I will recognize that biasness. But I think that people that get these books, these are not just powerful stories. They're told in a very timeless way. The way that you told your story, the way that Miriam told her story, and the way that that translated on paper. So we have those books available now at Back to Jerusalem. You can go and buy them in a package. We have it called Mothers of the Underground. The three books are together. You can buy those three books for Mother's Day right now. If you're going to get them, is the time to get them, because once it becomes, you know, the week before Mother's Day, it'll be too late. Then you have to run around figuring out what you're going to get. Now is the time to get those books. If you want to learn more about Nagmeh and what she's doing, you can go to her homepage at nagmehpanahi.com. NagmehPanahi.com, and then also you can find a button there to support the work that she's doing in Iran and Afghanistan and other places as well in the Middle East. You can donate directly to her ministry and the work that she's doing, and also get her book to share with others in Mothers of the Underground. Nagmeh, thank you so much for being with us. If somebody wants to know more about you besides your website, how can they follow you? How can, you know what? My bad. You have a new podcast coming out. How can people
find
how can you find that podcast?
We're actually going to probably launch it in June, but it's called Hanging On Podcast, because me and my two other girlfriends are really, it's about hanging on to Jesus. And it just felt life has been, a lot of times you're just holding on. You're not necessarily like, you're just standing your ground. And so, so that podcast will be out soon. But I'm on social media, but I think all the things we talked about, meeting with the Iranian president, all that in the book. But if you just Google my name, a lot of things will come up.
Yeah. So Nagmeh Panahi, a new podcast coming out in June called Hanging On. Look for it. Download it where you get your podcast. Will you have it on your website?
Yes. We'll put it up there.
And we will definitely cover it, do an article and another podcast about it to share it with our audience as well. Hanging On Podcast. NagmehPanahi.com for her work in the Middle East, and then the book that she has right now that you can get in the Mothers of the Underground package, I Didn't Survive, along with Smuggling Light and Shackled. Thank you so much, Nagmeh.
Thanks, Eugene.
It's a blessing. Thank you guys so much for joining us for another Back to Jerusalem podcast. Again, I'm Eugene Bach, your host for this time, coming to you live on delay from somewhere within the borders of America. God bless.